Take a deep breath in and feel the quiet of this sacred space enfold you. A wave of peace is centered at the crown of your head, and it settles down past your ears, loosens your neck and shoulders, relaxing any tension held in your body in this moment. And as this gentle wave of peace settles you more deeply into your chair, any remaining tightness is swept away with a slow, relaxing out-breath. Here, in your heart this morning, close the door to the outer distractions of the day and rest in the arms of Spirit for a while. Just for this moment, close out the sounds of the world and focus instead on the slow and steady heartbeat that is uniquely yours. In this place of deep peace and oneness, we put aside all worries and brush off confusion or concern. In the stillness here, my heart is lighter, my perceptions clearer, as all imagined burdens are released to God. And with my next cleansing breath, I begin to refuel my hope. Today, as our outer world can seem in such disharmony, how good it is to rest and affirm peace to our world and everyone in it. Here in the calm peace of my soul, where nothing and no one can disturb me, I know once again that my words have power and that I can make a difference. I know that every positive thought I hold, every kindness I share, every smile I offer throughout the day brings another blessing to the world. Every time I truly listen with my heart easy and open, more and more understanding and calm and divine discernment pours in. My prayers with thousands of others at this very moment are raising the vibration of our planet to new levels of compassion and courage. This is our day to boldly speak words of hope and peace to our world. Let those words come clearly into your heart now, that whatever is yours to do this week, you will bring the full love of Spirit to light this path. That love will inform every decision. That love will keep our hearts open and strong. In love, we know what to do and how to do it. And now we call forth all the good and peace of God as we move gently into a time of silence. We are peace-filled as we return from this time apart. Our hearts are radiant with peace and hope this morning, and divine love moves through me into the world. And so it is. Amen.
Good morning. Whew, it's so good to be back in New York and at Unity. I wanted to first just take a breath, if we could take a collective breath, and just send some really, really strong, positive, healing energy to the spiritual director here at Unity, Britt Hall. So if we could just take a deep breath together. Inhale, exhale, and know that right where he is the power of healing, the intelligence of the body temple, knowing how to heal rightly, completely, full energetic, so that Britt continues to do what he's called to do here. And so it is. Amen. So I always tell people that I grew up here in New York City. I always tell them that. The 8 years that I spent here, I grew up in New York. I was actually born and raised in Nashville, Tennessee, in a small community that was founded in, some Nashvillians here, founded in 1868 by a missionary by the name of Mr. Ace H. Simpson. And the story goes on, and it's told throughout the ages, that this little man, about this tall, stepped into a field of thickets and brushed and says, "This is where I will build my church because God has ordained me to do so." And right there, he built his church. I'm fifth generation, so my grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents settled here. Now, by the time I came along, this little town called Lake Providence had become a major artery in the city of Nashville. The Nolensville Road had become one of the busiest streets there. And I used to stay with Granny, my paternal grandmother. She was born in 1901, and Granny would tell me these fabulous stories. And I'd say, "Well, Granny, how did that get here? And how did that get here? And how are you still here?" And my grandmother would tell me things. She would introduce me to principles like community, service, excellence, compassion. At the age of 3 and 4 years old, some of those things go right over your head. You don't understand what compassion is. You don't get the full gist of what community is. I didn't. I said, "Granny, what does community mean?" She says, "It means getting from, making good for yourself, and giving it back." That's how we sustained it here. That's how we're still going, and that's how I'm still here. I'm the third child, the baby. I'm the youngest by over a decade. And I'm the youngest grandchild by over a decade. So you know what that meant. I got everything I wanted. With a please and a smile, it'll do the trick every time. Those were the perks of growing up. The other side of it was acquiescing to what everybody thought you should be when you grow up. "He's going to be a preacher," my grandmother said. My mother said, "Oh, no, he's going to be a businessman. He's going to climb to the top of the corporate ladder." My uncles had seen me play ball, and they said, "Oh, he's going to play professional baseball or professional football one day." And so I lived my life according to the wishes of other people. I went to church every Sunday, made straight A's, became the celebrated athlete. And I remember all during that period of time championing the wishes of other people and having my mother and everybody else champion what I did, there was one person who I couldn't quite get to understand what this was all about, and that was my father. My father was born in 1925. Old school, as they say. A man of order. And emotionally vacant. No crying. No touching. You sit up straight. And I could deal with it. It was just that I came here the opposite. I like to talk to grown-ups. I like to touch people. I cried when I had to. And so it seemed that this life that I thought was just delicious from the start was turning sour. My relationship with my father became a thorn. Now, I will have to say that when I was growing up, my father was my hero. He was my king. I wanted to be just like my daddy. I wanted to walk just like my father. I wanted to walk, talk, eat like my daddy. My father would put his elbows on the table, and I would put my little elbows on the table and pretend I was. But after a while, this began to turn sour again. By the age of 8, I thought to myself, well, since my father thinks that what I'm doing is not good, that it's wrong, then something must be wrong with me. Now, hence, this is when things began to change. I said, let me fix it. Fix it quick so that nobody sees it. And at every corner, I tried my best to get my father to approve me, to validate me. Dad, I made straight A's. My father was very stoic. Mm-hmm, he'd say. I see a chick by talks too much in class. What are you going to do about that? Those types of things were important, but I wanted him to say, I'm proud of you. I just needed somebody like my father. I needed my father to tell me, son, you did a good job. And I spent the majority of my life chasing it. And by the age of 15, I said, you know what? It's just not going to happen. He doesn't like me. And so I created these volumes in my mind around my relationship with my father. Very painful. But I thought to myself, if I can just get to the next accolade, if I can just get to the next assignment, if I can make straight A's one more time, that will do the trick. That'll help heal my pain. And it really didn't. But I would sweep everything under the carpet from shame, blame, disappointment, abandonment to get to that next accolade or that next achievement. If I can just get there. I remember I graduated from college, and soon after college, I got a job with IBM. When I graduated, IBM was at the top of the Fortune 500 list. And I rushed to Nashville. I was living in Memphis at the time, and I rushed to Nashville, and I said, this will do it. This is going to do the trick. And I rushed in, and of course, my mother was already happy, and I said, Daddy, guess what? I just got a job with IBM. A marketing representative. I'm making this amount of money, and I've moved out. I have my own apartment. I'm responsible now. I'm a man now. And my father looks at me and he says, mm-hmm, I see. And that's it. I was driving back to Memphis, and there was a billboard on the street, side of the street, and it said, Jesus cares for you. You know, I'm from the South. Religion is a real thing in the South. And I pulled over, I remember, and I looked at the sign, and I said, I don't care if Jesus cares for me. I want my daddy to care for me. It was at that time that I realized that this pain and disappointment, it was really getting a hold of me. I left IBM after 2 years, moved to another city, started another corporate job, and a year later they fired me. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't know what I should do, but I sure wish I had the advice of my daddy. But someone did show up and said, you know, maybe you ought to think about going into musical theater. One of the other points of being with Granny was my grandmother was a self-taught pianist. She used to pretend like she was tapping these notes out on her knees, and she'd teach me these hymns. I had started singing in these nightclubs, these jazz clubs, and I'd started singing these songs that Granny had taught me. The gentleman had heard me and said, maybe you ought to go into musical theater. I said, musical theater? I'm a football player. I don't pirouette, tondu. He said, you'd be great at it. I took him at his word, and I started auditioning. Didn't know anything about it. And I booked every single gig that I went and auditioned for. Not only did I book the gig, I booked the lead. There was something to this. Something to this that was drawing me. So July 6, 1996, I said, I'm going to make a big decision in my life, and I'm going to move to New York City. Now, anytime you make a rash decision like that, there's one person who you have to clear it with. Not daddy, it's mama. And if you know mamas, you know how mothers are. Now, my mother had championed me all the way up to this point. And my mother has an interesting way of giving you indication of just how she feels about your decision. So I call my mother, and my mother knows, I think mothers know when their children are throwing them a curveball sometimes. And I said, Mom, guess what? I said, I'm going to move to New York. She said, let me get something right with you, son. You had a great job right out of college. You graduated from a great school, fast track at IBM. You leave IBM, you go to another company, they fire you, and now you want to move to New York City. The most insane place on the face of the planet. And you want to be on Broadway? You don't know anything about Broadway. I said, I need to get to Broadway. I have to get to Broadway. So I purchased a one-way ticket, July 6, 1996. And I made my way here, 87th in Columbus. I was staying with a friend of a friend. And I walked out and I threw my arms open and I said, I'm home. I needed that. There had to be some kind of shift in my life so that I could gather my thoughts and gather my things. And the first job that I got, which was a month after I arrived here, was Jesus Christ Superstar. It wasn't just any Jesus Christ Superstar. It was with Ted Neely and Carl Anderson, the original Jesus and Judas from the 1972 picture. I played Simon. And I remember when I got on that bus, that sleeper bus, I said, yes, I did it. I'm here in New York. And I'm far away from him. See, this thing had followed me. All of the accolades, if I could just get to Broadway, if I could just get to that next assignment, if I could just book the next show, everything will be just fine. We were in Casper, Wyoming. We'd just done a show on our way back to Long Beach. This was a big national tour. And I had had some sleep on the sleeper bus, and I got up after a couple of hours, and I started talking to the bus driver. And I remember when we were talking, there was something that whizzed past the bus. And I took a good look at it, and I said, catch up to that. What was that? What was that? And he said, I think it was a tumbleweed, but I'll catch up to it if you want me to. We caught up to it. It was a tumbleweed. I said, I've never seen a tumbleweed before, only in the movies. We continue our conversation, and out of the right periphery, I see something coming towards the bus. I continued talking. It continued coming. And all of a sudden, I made a swift turn. And there in front of me, was the face of my father. I said, what are you doing here? I thought I left you in Nashville. You didn't want to be around me anyway. Why are you following me now? The tour ended after 6 months, and I found myself sitting on the corner of my bed. I was living in Harlem, 153rd and St. Nicholas Place. And I remember I sat on the bed for about 5 minutes, and I heard a voice say, call him. Call him now. And I took a deep breath. I gathered all of the courage that I could gather at that moment, and I pressed those numbers. And my mother answered the phone, and I said, Mommy, is Daddy there? She said, he's right here. I said, let me speak to him. I have to tell him something. My father picks up the phone, and in that stoic voice, hello. All of the courage that I had garnered left. And I went into this rant. I said, do you remember when you said this to me? Do you remember when you did this to me? When you wouldn't let me go here, when you accused me of something that I didn't do, I couldn't have done it. Do you remember any of that? Silence on the other end of the phone. And then I heard the voice say, say it. Say it. And I said, Daddy, I forgive you. Silence. Well, I was pissed. You're not going to say anything? So I found the other side of that laundry list and I went down that one. Do you remember any of this? And my father politely, in the southern voice and the lilt that he had, he said, I'm going to stop you right now. I think you got the wrong person. I don't remember saying any of that. I don't remember doing any of that. Well, I was furious at this point. But at that moment, I heard the voice speak again and say, tell him what you really think about him. I know what you want to say, but speak the truth. Speak your truth. And I said, Daddy, I love you. I always have, and I always will. Silence. I got off the phone and I cried and I cried and I cried and I woke up. It was so strange. I woke up about 3 o'clock in the morning. Sounded like there was a band playing outside of my apartment window. So I wake up and all I hear is, congratulations! I said, congratulations for what? You just stepped into your sacred covenant. Now, I knew what a covenant was. It was something that you make with yourself. You told the truth. You said how you really felt about him. And that's all you could do. But I wanted him to say, that's all you could do. Congratulations. And I spent from 1997, that was January of 1997, all the way to 2009 telling my father, every time I'd see him, Daddy, I love you. Call you when I get back to New York. Let you know I made it, okay? And every time his response was the same. I was trying to allow myself to let it wash over me, all of the angst and anxiety of wanting and needing him to say, I love you back. But I could not lie. I was waiting for it. I waited for it from 97 until 2009. And I went home, and by this time, my father had been diagnosed with end-stage renal disease. I walked in. He was coming back from a session. My father was this tall when I was growing up. He was about this tall now, shuffling back to his room. And I was just patiently following him, still loving him. And he got to the table. He's about to sit down and have some breakfast. And he took a swift turn and he says, ah, there's my baby. Daddy loves you. Well, there were two sides. Seemed like my feet were straddling. There was that side that was asking, begging, please tell me why. Why didn't you tell me this when I was 4 and 5 years old, when I was grabbing your pant leg, begging you to come out and play ball with me? Could you have told me that at the age of 13, that I meant something to you, that you were proud of me, that you loved me then? And then I heard that other voice. The other voice said, "Woo! You remember the covenant? He's ready now. Are you?" And I stood there and I looked at my father and I said, "I love you too, Daddy." It felt like at that time it took everything inside of me to allow that to come up. Things had changed. But I was ready. The last 5 days of my father's life, which was February of 2013, I was right there at his bedside. I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and I flew in. In the first 2 days, my father was just a little coherent. Last 3 days, he was not. I went into meditation while I was in the room with him. Now, I've always known that there are different levels and different realms of conversation, so I wasn't worried about that. So I beseeched him, "Daddy, talk to me now." And I said, "What was this all about, the relationship between us? You're getting ready to move into another dimension, and I'll be left here. What was it all about? What was the lesson that you want me to take?" And he said, "First of all, I want you to know I loved you from the time that you were conceived, the time that they told us, the time that you were brought home. I loved you. I just couldn't tell you like you wanted me to, because nobody told me. My father didn't tell us that he loved us. The times that I was trying to get you to stay on the narrow path, I tried to scare you, tell you you'd end up in juvenile. I know you were making great grades, but this was my way of saying, son, I see the brilliance inside of you. Don't go that way. Keep going this way." But I couldn't say it like you wanted me to. But one thing I did do, I did my best. And then there was that part of me that said, "Don't let him off, don't let him off. Keep him, keep him, keep him." And I said, "I get it. What do I take with this?" My father said, "There, our story was unique to us, but it's not unique. Go out and teach the kids. Teach the youth. Learn how to navigate through pain, disappointment, shame, and blame. They need you. It was painful, I know, but turn it into something good. Turn it into something good. My father left, and before he left, he said, and I'll be able to travel with you everywhere you go. I'll be there. I believed it. As a matter of fact, I know it. I said, okay, Daddy, that's what we'll do. So long. Are there days when I still ask, I wonder why he didn't hold my hand and take me to church with him? I wonder why he never told me that he was proud of me. Oh, I wish he did. I wish he did. There are days that I have with that, but I remember the covenant. And then I look at the world and I say, wow, I think I was sent to break a cycle. If the peace that we all want and that I want is to be realized, to be demonstrated, I have to first be that. That's what my daddy taught me. If the love that I want to experience, if it is to be manifest, I have to become that myself. It's not left up to somebody else. It's left up to me. My father taught me that. Whatever it is that I believe and come to know, that's up to me to find it out, and I can do it. Daddy taught me that. Relationships are sometimes real tough, especially when it's somebody who you're really close to. But as I come to a close, I'll invite you to find that one. Find that one that seems really hard to get under, to move that rock so you can find the treasure trove, because I did, and I'll continue to search. But I think what is happening now is that we've been given an opportunity to say, if it is to be, then it's got to be up to me. Because nobody else is going to do it. And then we become that energetic. We become that compassion. We become that loving person or whatever it is. Authentically being truthful with ourselves, but nevertheless, what we came here to give, to share, to be, to demonstrate, and to become. Let's take the breath together here. And I'll invite you, if there is someone or something that comes into your purview, into your mind right now, that you know has been just after you. Everywhere you turn, you see their face, you hear their voice. You remember what happened. I invite you to let it go, knowing that it will come back to be released again. It's like an onion peeling back the layers. Sometimes the onion juice gets in your eyes and you cry. I'll invite you to do that. And I'll invite you to step into your holy, sacred covenant. And no matter what anyone does or says to me, I'm going to stay in my truth. You can open your eyes now. I thank you for your time. I bless you, Unity of New York. I bless you with all my heart. And I'm so grateful that you've given me the opportunity to share my truth, to go on to do what I've been called to do. Thank you.